In your book, The Whale, A Love Story, it's based off of these letters that you read, written between Nathaniel Hawthorne and Herman Melville. And I want to know how you felt just reading those letters. If there was ever a point in your research that you felt kind of uncomfortable or maybe like you were breaching some sort of level of trust.
Well, the letters from Melville to Hawthorne are really well known, and scholars have been reading and interpreting them for decades, and they're reprinted in almost every edition of Moby Dick. So I didn't feel like I was violating any trust. Both of these writers are such iconic figures in American literature that their journals and letters have already been combed over. So it wasn't so much that I felt like I was reading their into their private lives, as much as I thought it was astonishing that the surface of the letters, just what they said, had not been dealt with by scholars before. They're very provocative letters. I just couldn't believe that no one else had seen what seemed so obvious to me.
There was this kind of perceived romance between Melville and Hawthorne, and I want to know: were they in love? Do you think?
I think Melville was in love with Hawthorne. I don't think there's much question about it. And this actually has been a kind of open secret in universities and the academy for decades. People started doing this kind of analysis in the 1950s. What's less certain is how Hawthorne felt. We know that he responded positively to Melville's attentions because of the things that he wrote in his journals and the letters that he wrote to other people. But Melville destroyed all of the letters that Hawthorne wrote to him. And he destroyed them at Hawthorne's request, which is a very unusual thing to ask someone to do.
You spent time as a journalist, and I want to know how your experience there helped you put this book together.
It made me very suspicious of myself. That when we read back, not just to our contemporaries' letters, but to the letters of people in history, we have a tendency to see them through our own lens. And the farther back in history you get, the more that lens might shape your interpretation. So when I first read the letters, I thought it was really they were very provocative, like I said, and they seemed obvious what was going on. But I didn't want to take it at face value because I'm looking at it through the lens of a 21st century reader, and I've read Freud, and postmodernism has happened, and all the things that have developed, in between the time. Made me think that I might have just been reading into it. So, in doing the research for it, I was constantly wondering, what am I bringing to this? How do I filter my own perspective out? And that's just the journalistic idea. Like, you have to have an opinion. You're born, you're sort of born with an opinion, but how do you filter it out to get to the facts? How do you perceive and then convey the truth?
And I want to know if there was a time when, through the course of your research, where you kind of had to like check your feelings, or maybe you totally misinterpreted something because of that lens that we're talking about.
Well, there are a couple of wonderful books about the difference between the way society is configured today and the way society was configured in New England in the 1850s. There was no word homosexual. There was no word. Well, there was a word gay, but it didn't mean homosexual. So we didn't have the categories that we do today, and it made identity and identifying a lot more fluid. There was just a range of things that you could feel. But it also made it more difficult to identify other people who were feeling those same things. So this tension is really interesting. And it's not so much that I was surprised by things that I discovered. What astonished me actually was that people could still form communities and still find communities when they didn't have ways to name them.
Now, how familiar were you with this time period before you started your research?
Almost not at all. I mean, I'd read, Thoreau and Emerson and Oliver Wendell Holmes and William Cullen Bryant. I mean, I studied English, so I got the New England Renaissance in school. So I knew it through literature, but I didn't know the nuts and bolts of what life was like then. And I really enjoyed actually just digging in to the small details. I mean, I almost think of it as, when you read Moby Dick, there's so much information about whaling boats and you know, how do you make a harpoon? What is the rope like? You know, what kind of stores do you take on board? How is a Dutch whaler supplied versus an American whaler? So there's this incredible attention to detail. And I sort of use that almost as a guide when I was thinking about, you know, what detail to put in. Is this a historically accurate detail? Would someone wear jeans? Did the word jeans exist? Would they wear dungarees? What's a dungaree? So these are kind of eggheady, you know, nerdy things to think about. But I was really fascinated by the differences in life then and now. And it was one of the things that kind of fueled my research.
What surprised you the most that you found out?
Well, I was surprised by how much whaling influenced everyday life in 1840s and 1850s America. In 1838, the economy crashed in a similar way to the way it did in 2008. And that's how Melville actually got on board a whaler, is he couldn't find a job on land. And that was the way many young men found their first jobs. They went off on whaling adventures. So although we think of it as exotic today, and Moby Dick is a strange kind of outlier novel about this odd subject, whaling was pervasive in America, and I just had no idea. And also, a lot of the funding from the railroads that we built to move people west came from whaling companies.
And are there any like residual effects of that? Obviously, railroads, that whole infrastructure wouldn't exist, but I wonder if there's anything else.
Well, there are a lot of funny little quirky holdovers and vestigial remnants of whaling, like some of the companies. Macy's department store, for instance, you know, the Macy's family was a big whaling family, and Macy's began as a supply company for whaling ships. In fact, the next time you go by a Macy's, there's a big red star as their logo, and that red star was, I've forgotten the first name of the son, but the Macy's founder's son went off to the South Seas and got a tattoo in the Marquesas Islands of that red star, and he loved it so much that he made it the logo of the company when he took over.
And I imagine, too, that in a time when, in American history, when everyone was talking about slavery and state politics, that your whole interpretation and perception of this time period in America has totally changed since doing all this research.
Yeah, and there's, you know, the thing that's happening in this election cycle has interesting resonances from the 1850s as well. You mentioned slavery. Women didn't have the vote at this time. We had just fought a war. We just started and won a war with Mexico. So there a lot of the issues that were happening around the time of Moby Dick are also happening now. You know, minority rights, gay rights, women's rights, the role of America in the world. Are we an imperialist country? So all of these – so during the course of the writing of this book, those things did change somewhat and they developed somewhat. But a lot of the things that we've been dealing with for the last 6 or 8 years, which is how long the book took, are the same ones that they – that Melville and Hawthorne and his their contemporaries dealt with for the years leading up to the Civil War.
You have a bit of a connection to Aspen. You were here on Saturday at Explore Booksellers, and I want to know if you could explain what you have going on.
I first came there about 12 or 13 years ago because I met a woman named Rose Tadero who grew up in the area, and she's a violinist, and she played at the Aspen Music Festival, and through her, I met her father, Frank Tadero, who's a jazz pianist, and his son, Anthony, is a deputy sheriff now in Pitkin County. So through them, I feel like I got sort of a back door into Aspen, because they've just lived there for so long and know so many people. And I was lucky enough through their family to be introduced to an Aspen that you don't necessarily get as a tourist. So just hanging out, and, you know, in the restaurants with them, and meeting the locals, and exchanging stories, and hearing, you know, how everything developed from the time of the '60s, which was so different to the way it is now, is really fascinating, and it really made me love Aspen in a way that I don't think I could have if I had just come as a tourist, just to ski or whatever.
All right, Mark Beauregard, the author of The Whale: A Love Story. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.